We're all more familiar with viruses than we wish we were. Like before the COVID-19 pandemic, COVID viruses existed, but I couldn't tell you anything special about them. And now I know so many terrible things. Same goes for the flu and measles and Zika. I wish we lived in a world without those deadly viruses. But since they're a part of our lives, we need to get to know the enemy so we can fight them as effectively as possible. So, here's everything you didn't want to know, but should, about viruses. Let's start with what viruses even are. And the answer gets surprisingly deep. It all goes back to one of the biggest unanswered questions of the human existence. What's the meaning of life? But in biology, it's still debated whether viruses are alive or not. Michael can lay out the debate for you now.
Viruses are arguably the most notorious parasites on Earth, and they can be kind of creepy to think about since they don't just make you sick, they actually hijack your cells to make more of themselves. We can try to kill them with chemicals or UV light or design vaccines to thwart them, but even then, they often evolve to evade our efforts. Except, all of that's kind of wrong. Or at least, really weird to say because most scientists don't consider viruses to be living things. How do you kill something that's not alive? Or how can a non-living thing evolve? This isn't just a philosophical question or a quirk of language. In fact, whether viruses should be considered alive is an incredibly stubborn problem in biology. And when we try to finally pin an answer to it, things get difficult, if not a bit absurd. But maybe that's okay, because life might just be a bit absurd. And if we really want to try to find every living thing on this planet or figure out if any life exists elsewhere, we'll need to confront that absurdity. Part of the problem is that there's no single agreed-upon definition of life. One scientific analysis found more than 100 examples of people trying to come up with a definition. Potential definitions generally tend to focus on hallmarks of life, like whether the thing in question is able to maintain some sort of metabolism, a stable system of chemical reactions that provides energy. Being able to reproduce on their own is important too, as well as the ability to evolve via natural selection. And a lot of the time, these hallmarks exclude viruses from being placed on the tree of life. But it turns out that excluding viruses for lacking these features is a bit problematic as well. There are quite a few things we consider more alive than viruses, even though they also lack some of those essential traits of living things. Like, certain kinds of bacteria can go inert or form spores. They're not able to grow and divide until they wake up. Still, we don't consider them dead. And there are things like Wolbachia, which are bacteria found inside the cells of many insects. They can't really survive on their own, not for long anyway, but they still count as alive, and viruses don't. You might say, aha, the difference is that Wolbachia, or these inert spores, still have that all-important cellular machinery. They've still got the genetic code for the machinery that turns genes into proteins, for instance. But so do some viruses, apparently. Mimiviruses were originally discovered in 1992, and they are huge. They're large enough to be seen with a regular microscope. They are, in fact, so large that researchers initially thought they were bacteria. It wasn't until 2003 that we realized they were actually viruses. And they're not only big, they're weird. Their genomes are complex, with over 900 genes. Previously, it was thought that viruses topped out around 200. More importantly, they seem to have some of the construction machinery needed to build the next generation of viruses. And these parts are functional. They directly participate in the process of making proteins. Don't get me wrong, they don't have everything they need to make baby Mimi viruses. They still can't reproduce on their own, but neither can Wolbachia. And the presence of these proteins may suggest that they could, way back when. Speaking of things that were once alive and independent, what do we do with mitochondria? They're specialized structures found in animals, plants, and other eukaryotic cells that look like little bacteria and produce the cell's energetic currency. They even have their own ribosomes and DNA. Still, they're not considered alive, even though they once were. They came into being because some bacteria set up shop permanently inside a cell, which, come to think of it, isn't all that different from those Wolbachia. You might think it's easy then. Viruses and mitochondria are alive. But if we're being generous with the life label, should we also extend it to much smaller parasites? Like Narnaviruses, They're so small that they don't even have a capsid, which is the name for the virus's protective coating. They're basically just a bit of protein and genetic material that floats around until it infects a fungus. And we can go even simpler. There are things like plasmids or viroids, which are just infectious genes, no proteins at all. There's even spooky stuff at the genome level. A certain type of virus called a retrovirus can also integrate its genes into a host's genome and then emerge again years later. And there are so-called selfish segments of DNA that can essentially cut themselves out of the genome, replicate, and then stitch themselves back in at new locations. Should we still talk about them as just a quirk of genetics, or are they more like viruses that just happen to live in our genomes? Anyways, the point is that whatever definition of life you use, when you try to actually apply it to the real world, it becomes hard to draw a precise line between alive and not, or chemistry and biology. Now, there are definitely people who still think viruses shouldn't be included in the tree of life and that conventional definitions work well enough. But others disagree, especially because delving into the complexity here can help us see viruses with new eyes and maybe even rethink our approach to the science of life. Before we get too deep into some of the alternative concepts here, we should note a few things. One, we're going to purposefully give a high-level overview of these ideas, so we're not going to hit every nuance. If you want to dive deeper, we'll link to some key papers in the description. Two, we're not saying these ideas are universally accepted, just that they're examples of how scientists are rethinking the definition of life. And lastly, while defining life based on what exists on one planet is bound to miss things, it's not a useless exercise. Different definitions can lead to different questions and different ways of understanding the world. And that's why some scientists have tried to rethink what a virus is and even proposed entirely new definitions for life. One interesting idea is that the little seed of illness version of a virus, what's called a virion, isn't really a virus, no more than a sperm is a person. Instead, it's only part of the virus life cycle. And viruses can be considered living cellular organisms once they've hijacked the internal machinery of cells. Inside a cell, a virus can reproduce, metabolize, and evolve. In this phase, it's what one researcher has dubbed the virocell. Strangely, this can happen in coexistence with the old cell. We know of viruses that don't destroy their host, just kind of hang out. And since both organisms could use the same cellular machinery to build things and reproduce, this means one cell could belong to two organisms at the same time. The distinction, then, between viruses and regular cells would be whether they have genes that code for ribosomes or for capsid coats. This doesn't totally give us clarity on what is and isn't alive, though, like those weird replicating proteins aren't included. For that, one of the main scientists behind this idea proposed that any individual thing that participates in a living process, from plasmids to elephants, should count as alive. A purposefully broad definition. Others think that the very idea of putting the label of life on things is somewhat silly. What you're really asking is, where can you draw the line? But everything we know of suggests that there are no lines, just fuzziness. In a 2016 paper, two researchers proposed something a bit radical. They suggested that all biological entities, from humans down to viruses and even extending to those weird edge cases like plasmids, are built of replicons, or units of reproduction. Any of these that are at least partly autonomous get dubbed replicators. And to count as that, there must be some trigger, some signal that can cause the replicator to reproduce independent of its environment. So a gene embedded in a huge chromosome might not count because it can't replicate independently of the rest of the chromosome, but a virus would. We can still draw some distinctions, like whether a replicator can produce its own energy and resources, as a cell does, or whether it parasitizes others, like a virus. Some borderline situations may still exist within those, but notably, this does away with the question of whether viruses are alive, because it groups everything we've discussed so far under one header. The replicators. Also, because replicators can cooperate with each other, they can build into yet larger replicators. Genes build cells, which build organisms. We can go from jumping gene and mitochondria to elephant without breaking the system. And it allows us to talk about the selfish end of things, like those weird self-replicating genes, without needing to draw too many lines. A self-copying gene is just a replicator in the larger elephant replicator group. In the end, when you consider these newer ideas and traditional viewpoints, viruses might be dead, or they might be alive, or they might be a process or event more than a thing, or they might be part of a spectrum of living things. We've certainly got options. As for why this matters, well, it's important to note that viruses are not just an unfortunate quirk of biology. They play an important role in ecosystems. For example, viruses are a key part of the ocean's nutrient cycle because they prey on and break apart bacteria and phytoplankton. They're also big players in evolution. By moving genes from one species to another or by causing mutations, they've shaped the genomes of all living things. We may have viruses to thank for our placentas, for example. It's even been suggested that the nucleus in our cells may have started as a virus that invaded some ancestral nucleus-free cell way back when. But more broadly, this matters because different definitions can affect the way we think and ask questions. The way we frame things can influence the kinds of questions we ask. For instance, if you're buying a house as an investment, you might have some questions about property taxes. On the other hand, if you're buying it as a home for you and your future family, you might ask about the school district or the neighborhood culture. Similarly, exploring different definitions of viruses could help us ask better questions about early life on Earth and what role viruses were playing back then. If we automatically accept the idea that viruses are a process cells go through, then by that reasoning, cells must have already existed. On the other hand, if viruses are just replicators, maybe some protoviruses did exist before cells, in which case, what were they doing? And was it important? Thinking about definitions could also help us search for life elsewhere in the universe. For example, a few papers have pointed to NASA's 1976 Viking mission to Mars. During that mission, in between all the geology and chemistry that needed to be done, scientists had enough room for just one experiment to look for life. After all, you can only fit so many instruments on a probe. The one that got selected looked for metabolic activity in the soil, and got inconclusive results. It made sense at the time. Metabolism is one of the traditional hallmarks of life. But would a different definition have resulted in a different test getting put on the probe? And if so, you just have to wonder, what kind of results might that test have gotten?
There's so many varieties of viruses, and there's still so much we don't have a solid answer for when it comes to them. It's enough to make you wonder if we'll ever be able to cure even the most common viral illnesses, like the common cold. It's been coming around every year of my life, and every year of my parents' lives, and every year of my grandparents' lives. Hank, when are we going to be free of the common cold?
Medicine has made some pretty big leaps forward in the last century. The one disease that still outwits even the best medical minds is the common cold. Part of the problem is that it's caused by a suite of pathogens, not just one. And those pathogens happen to be viruses that mutate fast and hide inside their host cells. That said, we might be closer to getting rid of it than you would think, and knocking out a slew of other viral diseases at the same time. One of the reasons the common cold is so difficult to attack is that it's not a single target. The main culprits behind the common cold are rhinovirus, but there are hundreds of variants of them, and they aren't the only viruses to blame. All that diversity has kept us from making any kind of cold vaccine or targeted drug. It's also why our best chance to defeat the common cold once and for all is to develop a broad-spectrum antiviral, a medication that can wipe out many different viruses at once. Since we've already done that with antibiotics, you might think it would be easy to apply the same strategy to viruses. Most broad-spectrum antibiotics work by inhibiting key proteins the bacteria need to reproduce or make their protective cell walls. These are usually things that are structurally unique to bacteria, as opposed to multi-celled organisms like us, so for the most part the drugs don't harm human cells. Viruses hijack their host cells to reproduce, using our cells' machinery for their own ends. So fighting these viral invaders while leaving our cells intact is a lot trickier. Not that we haven't tried. The first attempts at a universal antiviral tried boosting our body's natural immune system. When our cells detect a virus, they start making interferons, chemical messengers that signal the virus's presence to the rest of the body. So some of the first antivirals either were interferons themselves or boosted their effectiveness. And these drugs can work pretty well if taken before the virus gets out of control. One kind of interferon, interferon A, is still routinely used to treat hepatitis B and C, for example. But these drugs tend to come with a mess of side effects that happen when you somewhat indiscriminately ramp up your immune system. But what most antiviral researchers really want to find is something that targets viruses more directly. Kind of like the antivirals used against HIV. These medications take advantage of the way HIV inserts its genes into a person's DNA by targeting the viral proteins that allow it to do that. But the meds are designed to inhibit things specific to HIV so they don't work against other viruses. And finding a single Achilles heel common to many different viruses has proven difficult. Still, back in 2011, a team from MIT may have found one. They developed a protein that detects double-stranded RNA, a type of genetic code that is made by a lot of the most common viruses while they're replicating. These molecules aren't completely unique to viruses, but the ones made by viruses are much longer than the ones that happen naturally in human cells. In fact, their presence is one of the ways our own immune system figures out that you're infected. So the researchers took a protein that can detect these molecules, and they attached it to another protein which triggers cell suicide when more than one of the drug molecules binds to the same chunk of double-stranded RNA. And in a 2011 PLOS ONE study, they showed that this combined construct works against more than a dozen different viruses without harming several types of human cells. Killing infected cells might sound extreme, but the viruses are gonna kill your cell anyway when they've made enough copies, so the drug simply speeds things up and limits the number of viruses made. Unfortunately, the project has been in a constant battle for funding, so they haven't gotten far enough along in their research for human trials. Luckily, there are other promising antivirals in the works. A team of researchers in San Francisco is developing drugs that stop viruses from making the protein shells, or capsids, that they need to move about within and between hosts. Traditional studies have looked at capsid formation as a thing that just sort of happens on its own. But these developers tested the idea that the host cell unwittingly helps the virus with construction. And they found what appear to be traitorous proteins scientists had no clue were aiding the viruses, any of which could be a target for a broad-spectrum antiviral. Using this framework, the team has found inhibitors that work in animals against rabies, influenza, and Ebola viruses. But they still have a lot of testing to do before anything would be ready for human trials. And there's another broad-spectrum antiviral hoping to beat them there. This one takes advantage of natural hiccups in viral replication, because just like us, viruses aren't perfect. Sometimes during the gene copying process, they end up deleting big chunks of their own genes. These defective viruses are unable to make some really important proteins, so they can't infect healthy cells, but they can still create copies of themselves. And those copies, though harmless to your cells, get in the way of other viruses. So scientists have taken to calling them defective interfering viruses. Researchers are hoping to capitalize on these helpful defects by creating clones or synthetic versions. And so far, they've successfully treated multiple strains of influenza in mice with this approach. Of course, mice aren't people, so like other universal antivirals in development, there's a lot more work to be done. Still, the fact that there are so many potential broad-spectrum antivirals already in development is a really good sign. While scientists have yet to come up with the silver bullet, we live in exciting times. And it might not be too long before we can say to, like, the young whippersnappers out there, when I was your age, I got a cold.
Sure, maybe in the future we'll get to sit back in our rocking chairs and tell our grandchildren about how back in my day people used to get the cold. After all, that's kind of what our parents say about HIV. Here's why it's no longer the death sentence it used to be.
If you're looking for the virus that's challenged scientists the most in the last 40 years, HIV is it. For a while, every time we'd develop a new treatment for it, the virus would just mutate so the drug didn't work anymore. And even though the worst of the pandemic is over in the US, nearly 5,000 people around the world get infected with HIV every day, and we still don't have a vaccine or a cure. But in just a few decades, we've gone from knowing nothing about HIV and AIDS to being able to manage and control the disease. Today, with the recommended treatments, someone who's HIV positive is expected to live nearly as long as someone who's uninfected. And researchers are working on all kinds of new ideas to kick even more virus butt, including potential cures. When the AIDS pandemic was getting started back in 1981, we didn't know what caused the disease, and there certainly weren't any drugs to treat it. The most doctors could do was to treat the infections patients developed because the virus had killed off so many T cells that they were left with basically no immune system. One of the very first drugs that showed promise against the HIV virus itself was Suramin, a medicine already being used to treat tropical diseases. It reduced the amount of virus in cells grown in petri dishes and in patients' blood. But in a small clinical trial, it didn't help patients at all, and it actually made them sicker because the drug was pretty toxic. Labs then started to test old compounds for anything that might work, and eventually they found something. It was called azithromycin, or AZT. It had been a candidate for a cancer drug back in the 60s, but it never really went anywhere. Now it seemed to keep HIV-infected cells alive longer, at least in the lab. Excited scientists rushed AZT into trials with patients, including a placebo-controlled trial, which investigators decided to end early because the drug worked so well. Although the trial had a lot of flaws, patients getting AZT had more T cells and were much less likely to die. In March of 1987, the FDA approved it, making AZT the first AIDS drug in America. But it was not cheap, and it came with a bunch of side effects, like anemia, muscle weakness, nausea, heartburn, insomnia, and heart and liver damage. AZT works against HIV because it blocks reverse transcriptase, the enzyme that copies the virus's RNA-based genome into DNA. But AZT also does something similar to a human enzyme, which causes some of those nasty side effects. Doctors eventually realized that a lower dose of AZT could get rid of a lot of those problems, but the drug had an even bigger pitfall. It only worked for a limited time. After a while, the levels of virus in the person's blood started to tick back up because it had mutated in a way that meant AZT couldn't block reverse transcriptase anymore. And that's the major challenge with treating HIV. It develops resistance to drugs really easily because it tends to make a lot of mistakes when it's copying its genome. Most of the time, these mistakes are bad for the virus, but every now and then, the mistakes are helpful. Over time, and with selection, HIV will mutate to get around whatever drug you throw at it. But as scientists would soon discover, there is a way to fight back. You just need to combine a bunch of different drugs that can target the virus at other stages of its life cycle. Like the first protease inhibitor, which was approved in December of 1995. Proteases are enzymes that cut proteins into smaller pieces, and HIV uses one to make a lot of the proteins it needs, including the proteins it uses to infect new cells. So with a protease inhibitor, the virus is still making new baby viruses, but they can't do much. On their own, protease inhibitors weren't much better than AZT. They also had some pretty severe side effects and only worked until the virus mutated. But now, doctors had drugs that targeted two different parts of the HIV life cycle, which meant that they could combine them, making it much harder for the virus to mutate to escape both drugs. That changed everything. In 1996, doctors started giving patients these combo cocktails made of at least two and soon three or four drugs. They called it highly active antiretroviral therapy, or HART, because it worked so much better than the individual antiretrovirals. Patients started living longer. The levels of virus in their blood went down and stayed down, and their T-cell counts stayed high. Today, it's often just called antiretroviral therapy, or ART, because it's the standard treatment. We now have dozens of different drugs that can make up that cocktail, many with fewer and less severe side effects than before. This is the breakthrough that changed HIV infection from a death sentence to a chronic disease. It's also helped with preventing the spread of HIV, because ART is now so effective that the amount of virus in patients is often undetectable. Not only does that make the infected person feel better, but it's also much harder for them to spread the virus to others. Some of the most compelling evidence for this comes from a 2016 study that monitored 1,000 gay and straight couples for HIV transmission. One partner was HIV positive, but on ART, and didn't have much of the virus in their blood, while the other was HIV negative. The couples had sex and didn't use condoms. Normally, this would be a recipe for disaster, but none of the HIV-positive people passed the virus to their partner, despite 58,000 condom-free sex acts. That's not to say that you shouldn't use a condom, because there are still lots of things that can go wrong, not to mention the other reasons they're important. But it's still some pretty solid evidence that treatment can also double as prevention. So the more people who can be put on ART, the better, not just for them, but for everyone. Researchers have taken this idea a step further with what's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, where people who are at high risk of infection also take antiretrovirals. Studies have found that people who take a daily pill containing two antiretrovirals have a 90% lower risk of contracting HIV from sex, as long as they take it consistently. Which is actually one of the biggest problems in the HIV world. Things like side effects or trouble remembering when to take which pills can sometimes make it hard for people to stick to their medication schedule. But PrEP only works if the drug is in your system. If you skip a dose, there isn't enough of it to keep HIV from getting a foothold. And for someone with HIV, as soon as they stop taking their proper dose, even if they have almost no virus in their entire body, HIV will start to come back. By letting the virus replicate even a little, it could mutate, and because some of the drug is still around, it's the perfect environment to select for a drug-resistant virus that may be impossible to treat. The reality is, as good as antiretrovirals are, they can't eliminate every single virus, so an infected person has to take the drugs exactly the right way for the rest of their life. That's why many researchers still want to find a cure. There are two main types of potential cures: a sterilizing cure cure and a functional cure. A sterilizing cure is what you would think of as a cure, total eradication from the body with absolutely no virus left. With a functional cure, on the other hand, the person would basically be in remission. They could stop taking antiretrovirals, but somewhere deep inside them, they'd still have a small amount of the virus. Most researchers are focusing on a functional cure, because it turns out a sterilizing cure is extremely difficult. In fact, it's only happened for one person, a man named Timothy Brown, aka the Berlin patient. He was HIV positive and also had leukemia, so doctors had the idea to try to treat both with a bone marrow transplant using cells from an HIV-resistant person. HIV uses a surface protein called CCR5 to enter cells, and some people naturally have mutations in this protein that make it hard for HIV to infect them. Doctors gave Brown chemo and radiation to kill off his original immune cells, and then transferred in those special bone marrow cells. And to this day, he's remained HIV negative without having to take antiretrovirals. Technically, we don't know for sure if he's totally virus-free, but so far so good. Now, as amazing as that procedure was, scientists aren't exactly sure why it worked. It might have been because of the special cells, but it also could have happened when the immune cells from the donor attacked and killed off Brown's immune cells, along with the HIV inside them. In any case, we can't do it for everyone, because bone marrow transplants are super risky. Lots of people die from them. And if those HIV-resistant cells are critical, there's not exactly a surplus of them lying around, so right now, a sterilizing cure doesn't look likely. A functional cure is much more promising, and researchers are looking at a bunch of different strategies. One thing that they've tried is giving antiretrovirals extremely early on. This sometimes works for patients for many years, even a decade or more, but many people relapse and have to go back to taking medication. It would also be great if we could get the immune system to attack HIV and do the work the antiretrovirals do now. The problem is, HIV is very good at hiding. The virus stays hidden in cells called latent reservoirs, and it doesn't try to replicate in those cells, which means antiretrovirals have no effect. So even though the virus isn't causing any harm, it's still there, and it could become reactivated at any time. One possible way around this is to deploy CRISPR, the gene editing tool, to change the person's CCR5 proteins. The virus wouldn't be able to infect new cells, so even if it reactivated, it wouldn't be able to spread. The other main approach is to find a way to reactivate the HIV that's hiding and take care of it either with drugs or with the immune system, something scientists are calling the shock and kill strategy. At the very least, researchers are hoping to develop these methods into functional cures, but if they got every last virus, they could also be sterilizing cures. The ultimate goal would be to eradicate HIV completely, but after more than 3 decades of trying, we still don't have a vaccine. There are some promising leads, but it's been difficult because the virus mutates so rapidly, and it's hard to make one vaccine work against all the slightly different viruses out there. So we've come a long way, but there's plenty of work left to do.
Yep, rapid mutations are kind of a virus's best friend and our worst enemy. It's what makes a lot of them so hard to stomp out. But it's not necessarily what determines which viruses are the most contagious. For that, you'll have to listen to Stefan's video.
The word contagious probably conjures up all sorts of horrific images of Ebola or the plague, diseases that have a reputation for gruesome, indiscriminate killing. So you might be surprised to hear that when it comes to the world's most contagious diseases, those don't even make the top 10. The winners on that list can be 10 or more times as contagious as Ebola or the plague, and they aren't off in some remote jungle or a thing of the past either. They're right here, right now. In fact, measles, that almost eliminated virus now making headlines in places like Washington and New York, is one of the most contagious diseases we know of. And its contagiousness is a big part of why it's making a resurgence. Now, the word contagious has a very specific meaning to epidemiologists, the scientists that study how diseases spread. A disease is considered especially contagious if one sick person is likely to infect a lot of other people. And that's something that can be quantified. The average number of people that a single sick person infects is known as a disease's basic reproduction number, or R0. R0 is based on a number of factors, like the rate of contact between infected and susceptible people, how long an infected person is contagious, and the probability that an uninfected person will contract the disease if they're around someone who's sick. Because of that, it's not a fixed number. There are a lot of variables that can impact how contagious a pathogen will be in a specific environment. So contagiousness can vary from location to location and outbreak to outbreak. When R0 is less than 1, a disease is considered self-limiting. Basically, it's not going to spread through a population and will eventually just die out. When R0 is 1, a disease will kind of hang around, but it won't cause an outbreak. When R0 is above 1, things start to look bad because the number of infected people increases exponentially. But to put that in perspective, the most contagious diseases we know of have double or even triple digit R0s. That's why a disease like Ebola, which has an R0 between 1.5 and 2.5, can cause epidemics but isn't considered super contagious. It is very infectious, though. Infectiousness is measured by the infective dose, basically how many virus particles, spores, bacterial cells, or other sadistic little vehicles of doom it actually takes to make you sick. Ebola is also really deadly, so basically it's extra super terrifying. But if somebody in your town has Ebola, you could probably hit up the local grocery store without worrying. That's not true for really contagious diseases like measles. Measles is a vaccine-preventable disease that was basically eliminated from the United States at the turn of this century, but now it's clawing its way back. Yay. Measles R0s from previous outbreaks vary a lot, from about 5 to several hundred, depending on factors like population density and vaccination status. But taken together, it's clear that if no one is vaccinated, then an infected person with measles will likely infect more than a dozen other people, each of whom can go on to infect another dozen or so more people, and so on. And it takes vaccination rates above 95% to push that R0 to 1 or less to keep it in check. One of the main reasons measles is so contagious is that, kind of like Ebola, it's really infectious. It doesn't take a lot of virus to get you sick. If you're in close contact with someone who has measles and you're unvaccinated, your chances of getting sick are about 90%. Meanwhile, during flu season, you probably breathe in influenza viruses anytime you enter an enclosed public space, like an airplane or a daycare, without getting sick, most of the time. Another big reason it gets around is its route of transmission. Measles can go airborne, where it can linger for up to 2 hours. Theoretically, someone with measles can walk into an elevator, cough, and then 2 hours later, you can walk into the same elevator and catch it. You don't even have to be in the same room at the same time. And measles has a way to ensure a lot of little infectious viruses get into the air with every cough. As they say in real estate, it's all about location, location, location. The measles virus makes itself at home in your trachea, at the top of your respiratory system, so it's in a prime position to come out when you cough or sneeze. Other respiratory viruses, like influenza, have to travel much further in order to get out of your body. And Ebola, by comparison, is spread through bodily fluids, so you have to come into contact with things like blood, vomit, or feces in order to become infected. Which is much less likely than the elevator scenario, though infinitely more disgusting. Also, people with Ebola aren't contagious until they develop symptoms, so they're not really likely to wander around during the contagious period when they can spread the infection. People with measles can be contagious up to 4 days before the characteristic rash develops. So they might think they have a cold, shrug it off, and spend days walking around coughing, sneezing, pushing elevator buttons, shaking hands, or going to Disneyland before it even occurs to them that they should stay home. This sort of thing happens with other diseases too, like the bacterial illness pertussis, also known as whooping cough. Pertussis generally has an R0 of 12 to 17, which probably has something to do with the fact that adolescents and adults often get a mild, cold-like version of the disease or have no symptoms at all. That's simply not the case with influenza, which has a low R0 of around 1 or 2. People with the flu are only contagious for about a day before they develop symptoms. And they're most contagious when they're 3 or 4 days in, when they're most likely to be in bed. One of the only viruses to top measles' claim to contagious fame is rotavirus, the nasty stomach bug that's most common in children. It has an average R0 of about 25, and that's probably because, like measles, it's extremely infectious, but it's even hardier. It causes explosive diarrhea and is most common in children, so you can extrapolate from there how it gets around. Also, the virus is present in an infected person's feces before they develop symptoms, and it can last hours on unwashed hands, days on some surfaces, and weeks in drinking water. In fact, small kids with questionable hygiene is a common theme when it comes to super contagious diseases. That certainly helps measles move around schools and daycares, and it's part of why chickenpox generally has an R0 of 10 to 12. The virus can be passed through the air, but it's also present inside the pustules that develop, so it can get all over kids' hands when they scratch those itchy lumps. The virus that causes chickenpox probably doesn't survive too long outside the human body, though, which is why it doesn't quite have the legs that measles does. So, in conclusion, you should stockpile beans, rice, and bottled water and never leave your house. Or you could take reasonable precautions against contagious diseases. The contagiousness of viruses like measles is a big part of why we've developed vaccines against them. Because even if they're not as deadly as Ebola, they are still deadly. The likelihood that someone will die depends a lot on where they live. In developed countries like the United States, it's around 0.5%. But in developing countries, it's closer to 6%. Unfortunately, some people, like young babies or people with compromised immune systems, aren't able to get those vaccines. So if you want to help protect everyone around you and stay safe yourself, you can get vaccinated and get your children vaccinated on the recommended schedule.
Of course, children keep some of the most contagious viruses circulating around us. They're always touching and licking things. And most of them do not understand the concept of personal space, which is one of the reasons the chickenpox virus loves kids. The thing is, that same virus plagues adults when they get shingles. And Savannah has an explanation for that double whammy effect.
Chickenpox and shingles totally should not be the same thing. One is an itchy rash you get in childhood if you weren't vaccinated, and one is a totally different seeming bout of blisters and nerve pain that usually happens decades later in life. Yet both are caused not just by the same virus, but by the same incidence of the same virus. That's because chickenpox is caused by one of a group of viruses who excel at making themselves into unwelcome guests for life. But this particular virus has an even weirder way of doing things. Let's take a look at how it pulls off this annoying double feature. If you've had chickenpox, then you've experienced one of many types of herpes virus. For most people, chickenpox is an unpleasant but bearable childhood experience, though there is a rare risk of complications requiring hospitalization. Since the introduction of the chickenpox vaccine in 1995, cases of chickenpox in the United States, as well as hospitalizations, have dropped by over 95%. But infections still remain incredibly high at over 90% worldwide, since most countries don't include the chickenpox vaccine in routine childhood immunization. Though this figure technically includes some people who were vaccinated with a weakened version of the virus. If you're one of the people unlucky enough to have had chickenpox, you might remember an uncomfortable 4 to 7 days as your body fought off the virus and the relief when the symptoms finally cleared up. But unlike most other viral infections, just because the symptoms are gone, that doesn't mean the virus is. Herpes viruses like to move in and stick around, sometimes for life. So it's not that unusual for a herpes virus to infect you, get comfy, and reoccur years later. No, we're not going to talk about that herpes, but another friend you might have made in college. Mono. Epstein-Barr virus is another kind of herpes virus responsible for the fatigue-inducing, feverish, aching nightmare of mononucleosis, or mono as it's often known. During the initial infection, EBV hitches a ride in various immune cells where it borrows one of our own genes to boost its replication. Eventually, your immune system is able to take out the intruder and the symptoms clear up. But EBV doesn't die off as you'd expect. Oh no, it's just lying in wait. After a miserable 2 to 4 weeks of mono as your body fights the infection, the virus goes dormant in those immune cells it infected. It does this by expertly switching between two key phases of its life cycle. During the initial round of infection, herpes viruses are very active in what is known as a lytic infection. Here, the virus is using all of its genes to hijack the host cell's machinery and produce a horde of new virus particles. These can be neatly packaged up and released from cells, or the cells can burst open alien style and let loose their infectious passengers. Either way, the goal is clear. Go forth and multiply. But in order to remain a silent, lifelong infection evading an immune system which seeks to destroy it, the virus has to get really sneaky, entering a prolonged period called latency. Unlike the lytic infection, when the virus is incredibly active, very few genes are expressed during latency. But what few genes remain switched on can still achieve a lot. They keep the virus alive, making sure the virus is passed on when cells divide, but even more importantly, they act to tamp down other viral genes, making the virus nearly undetectable to our immune system. For most people infected with EBV, once the virus enters latency, that's the last they'll hear from it. But for an unlucky few, generally those who are immunocompromised, it comes back with a vengeance, reactivating its genes and reemerging with the same nasty symptoms. But when you get mono again, it's still mono. So why does shingles get to be special? Well, it starts a lot like EBV. Chickenpox is caused by the varicella zoster virus, or VZV. Though we're not sure of the mechanism yet, it's believed that the highly infectious VZV enters your body through the respiratory tract, where it makes its way to infect the T cells of the immune system. The T cells then go about their usual business, circulating in the blood where they unknowingly deliver the virus to your skin. Here, the virus causes the skin to break out in itchy, fluid-filled blisters. While your body is fighting the infection on one front in your immune cells and skin, the virus is sneaking behind enemy lines and setting up camp and entering latency in your peripheral nervous system, in clusters of nerve cells known as ganglia. The peripheral nervous system sends information all over your body. That's why the symptoms of shingles shingles can break out almost anywhere. We don't understand exactly how VZV hunkers down during this decades-long latency, but it relies on changing which viral genes get read out and put to use. One way is by switching on one of its genes called ORF63. ORF63 has been found to protect human neurons against apoptosis, often defined as programmed cell death, which is used to eliminate harmful cells. If a cell is damaged or infected with a virus or just old, the cell can say, "The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few," and pull a Mr. Spock to protect the rest of the body. By putting a hold on the normal cell death that comes with aging, the virus can comfortably live out its lazy latency days in a cozy neuronal home. VZV also uses another gene called ORF61 to maintain latency, but with a twist. During its busy replicating lytic infection, ORF61 encourages the virus's genes to be used at a greater rate. It increases the production of mRNA from those genes, which means they're getting read and turned into proteins more often, which makes ORF61 pretty important for the virus's replication during an active infection. This master of replication is still being produced by the hijacked neurons during latency, but it has an evil twin, almost literally. The ORF61 gene starts getting read backwards as well as forwards. Because of how base pairing works in nucleic acids, that means the backwards mRNA pairs with and sticks to the frontwards mRNA. The backwards version gets produced 5 to 9 times more than its counterpart, at least based on what we know from animal models. That means it totally swamps the frontwards version and prevents it from being made into a protein. That, in turn, puts a hold on viral replication and keeps the virus hidden from the immune system. There's even more going on that we don't totally understand yet, but it's clear that VZV is using clever genetic tactics to keep itself deep undercover in our neurons, biding its time until it just switches back on again. Because in about 1/3 of adults who have been infected and haven't had the shingles vaccine, it will switch back on. Gene expression ramps back up, and the virus begins to replicate again. New viral particles travel down the axons, or long stems, of the neurons they've been living in. Then the particles are released, causing painful lesions in the areas of skin the neurons connect to. And presto! Shingles. Even after the blisters fade, patients may continue to experience chronic nerve pain. So that is why chickenpox feels so different from shingles, despite being the same virus. One begins life in your immune cells, and the other in your neurons. This is unlike EBV, which infects and remains dormant in the same immune cells throughout its life, coming back around as a fresh case of mono. We still don't know exactly how and why VZV knows to rear its ugly head again, but the fact that shingles is most likely to occur in the elderly gives us a clue. The decline of your immune system with age may give VZV the perfect opportunity to spread more successfully than the first time around, now that your body is lacking its viral defense system. That's why the CDC recommends the shingles vaccine for people who are 50 or older, or people who are immunocompromised. Now, if they're caused by the same virus, it might seem odd that we have different vaccines for chickenpox and shingles. Unlike the chickenpox vaccine, which uses a whole but weakened form of VZV to build immunity, the shingles vaccine, Shingrix, contains just a single protein found on the outside of the virus. This means it can be administered to people with weakened immune systems, but is still enough for your immune system to know what to attack when VZV crops up again. There is also another shingles vaccine that's a live, weakened version of the virus, but we still keep them separate for safety reasons since they were tested on totally different groups of patients. Ultimately, the vaccines work in a pretty similar way, and right now it looks like kids who have had the chickenpox vaccine are a lot less likely to get shingles later on. But as the first large group of people to get the chickenpox vaccine got it in 1995, they're still relatively young, so that's definitely a thing we'll still be finding out for a while. The protection of a vaccine decreases the odds that VZV will come back around as a whole new illness. Although shingles won't happen to everyone who's had chickenpox, it can. As long as that virus is hanging out, it could come back. Herpes viruses, the gift that keeps on giving. Like the last guest at a dinner party, VZV refuses to leave even after our immune system has asked nicely, just hiding out in a different room of the house and remaining undetected until it finds the perfect moment to strike again, less welcome than ever.
Savannah said we weren't going to get into those other herpes viruses in the last video, but that means that we have to make a different video to talk about them, obviously. Here's what makes herpes so weird.
Getting sick is never pleasant, but at least many viral infections are one and done. We've talked before about how the measles virus is the poster child for lifelong immunity. Once your immune system recognizes it, it never forgets, and it will not hesitate to kick it to the curb if it shows its face again. Unfortunately, however, there is also a poster child for lifelong infection. Herpes viruses. These viruses are so good at sneaking past our immune system and hiding out in our cells that once we have them, We have them.
Because herpes viruses have some unique features that make them master squatters, which seems kind of embarrassing for our immune systems, but actually, we may have evolved to coexist. There are 8 members of the herpes virus family that routinely infect humans. These include herpes simplex virus 1 and 2, which cause oral and genital herpes, as well as the viruses that cause chickenpox and shingles, and most, but not all, cases of mononucleosis, or mono. Herpes viruses are nearly everywhere. It's thought that more people on this planet are infected with herpes simplex 1 than not. Herpes viruses are known for being unusually large and complex, as viruses go. Their genomes are so large with so many different genes that they can make dozens or even hundreds of proteins. That's way more than other viruses. Influenza virus genomes, for instance, only make 12 proteins. These proteins give herpes all kinds of tools that let it infect a host forever. Like a gang of thieves in a heist flick, these viruses slip past all of the traps and defenses our body puts out for them one by one. First, herpes viruses have to get past our innate immune system, the part of our immune system that holds off new, unknown invaders, without being noticed. It's a sneaky move known as immune evasion. The innate immune system's first line of defense against new threats starts with the production of proteins that kick cells into bouncer mode, setting off a huge signal cascade that ultimately prevents viruses from using host cells to replicate. But herpes viruses reduce the cell's production of those bouncer proteins, which dampen cells' first line of defense. But cells have backup defenses against viruses that can get past this pathway, which herpes also has an answer to. Herpes viruses can integrate themselves into the host's DNA, which can cause damage to the host's genome. And cells are normally super vigilant about monitoring for DNA damage. But herpes can convince them to overlook it. For example, herpes simplex virus 1 produces proteins that basically sabotage the cell's DNA damage warning and repair machinery and take it over. The next trap seems inescapable. When all else fails, a cell making a last-ditch effort to contain a virus will basically kill itself. But you probably know where we're going with this by now. Herpes has proteins that can evade the cell's self-destruct signals. Once it gets past the innate immune system, herpes has to stay out of trouble long enough to set up camp within the host cells. While it's working on that, herpes is in what virologists call the lytic phase. It's actively reproducing and sending out new viruses. And that gives the body's adaptive immune system, the one that develops antibodies that can bind to viral molecules or antigens, a chance to recognize those viral particles. But herpes puts the brakes on this process too. Normally, there are specialized cells that grab bits of viral antigens and show them to the immune system like molecular snitches. But herpes gums up the cellular machinery that would normally move antigens in position for the immune system to recognize it. Still, the host does eventually develop antibodies. Only by this time, it is too late. The antibodies can't clear the infection because herpes virus is already hunkered down inside the host's cells. This is called the latent phase. The virus packs up its genome in a tight circular form, and only certain parts of it continue to be expressed. For this to work, the cell it's using as a secret hideaway has to stay alive. So the viruses typically target types of cells that last a long time and perform critical functions, like neurons and immune cells. The body is a lot less likely to sacrifice those just to kill off a virus. Then herpes basically hangs out forever, or at least until the virus determines that it is safe to re-enter the lytic phase and reproduce, at which point, congratulations on your new cold sore. But it turns out, in a lot of people, herpes may be more of a frenemy than an outright foe. Herpes viruses certainly cause their fair share of problems. The infections can be severe for immunocompromised people, and they're a leading cause of blindness worldwide. They can also cause some cancers. But for the most part, herpes viruses have evolved to keep their hosts alive and healthy enough to interact with others and infect new hosts. Chickenpox blisters and cold sores are the exception. Many herpes virus infections are mild or totally asymptomatic. Like, by the time we hit 35 years old, most of us have been infected with the herpes virus known as Epstein-Barr. And most of those who are infected have no idea. That's right, EBV causes most cases of mono, but that miserable sore throat and fatigue doesn't happen to most people who get it.
Lucky them. And weirdly, having herpes hanging out might actually benefit our immune systems, but that is a story for another episode. In the meantime, if you had chickenpox as a youngster, at least now you know you had the privilege of hosting one of the most talented viruses around.
Hank hinted at the end that viruses aren't always bad and can sometimes be helpful. Now, here's some quick ads that we hope are helpful to you.
Thank you for watching SciShow. Big news! SciShow finally has dice, and you can get them now exclusively during the Complexly Learnathon. When you get our dice or any of our cool merch, you are supporting the free videos we put out 5 times a week here on SciShow, our deep dives, our SciShow residency, and new things we have coming soon. Thank you for supporting us, because good information is worth it. Go to complexlylearnathon.com to support us and check out all the free events happening this month, including a TTRPG with members of the SciShow team.
When somebody's talking about viruses in biology, they're usually talking about things that make you sick, stuff like the flu virus. And based on that, you might get the impression that all viruses are terrible, awful, no good things that just wreak havoc on humanity. But surprise, that's not actually true, and the truth is way more interesting. In reality, not only have some viruses helped us, a specific clade of them has given us some great adaptations and influenced our evolution for the better. Much of this research focuses on the human genome. Of course, your genome is the complete collection of your genetic material, including all of your DNA and the genes that comprise it. It contains everything you need to know to make a human. A lot of this material has been passed down from species to species for thousands or millions of years, which is why, generally, our genomes are pretty similar to those of other animals. But there are also places in the human genome that are totally unique. Maybe because some sequences got rearranged, or because some were inserted or deleted. Those kinds of changes translate to things like the proteins our bodies make, or the ways we develop. They're part of what makes us human. So it's not surprising that researchers have spent a lot of time trying to figure out where these changes came from. Over the years, they've learned that genomes can change thanks to a series of random DNA mutations, which might sound familiar from biology class. But what most bio classes don't talk about is how viruses also have a huge role to play here, especially a group called retroviruses. Retroviruses are kind of freeloaders. Like other viruses, they don't have much complex machinery, so they can't reproduce themselves. Instead, they depend on living things to do that for them. Retroviruses take their genetic material, insert it into a host cell's genome, and then rely on the host to replicate that material. Over time, the host helps crank out more and more copies of the virus, and the virus goes on to infect other cells and repeat this process all over again. Normally, when we talk about these things, we tend to focus on the viruses themselves, since those end products can cause illness. But there's a whole different piece of the puzzle here, because you have to remember those retroviruses don't just show up, replicate, and leave. They embed instructions for making new viral products in our DNA. Sometimes that's not a big deal, because those instructions can get eliminated by our immune systems, or if the virus only infected something like a skin cell, its genetic code won't get passed onto the host's offspring. But at multiple points in our past, our ancestors picked up viruses that happened to infect germ cells, like egg or sperm cells. And that means those viruses' DNA was passed to their host's offspring, and their offspring, and their offspring for thousands or millions of years, until virtually all modern humans had instructions for making certain types of viruses. These instructions, ones that have been passed down through germ cells for generations, are called human endogenous retroviruses, or HERVs. They make up almost 8% of our entire genetic code. 8% of us! And they've had a significant influence on how our bodies work. That influence starts early, too. Like, take one family of retrovirus called HERV H. It's a family that only primates have, and it started influencing your genetic code just a few days after you were conceived. For a short amount of time, your embryonic cells were pluripotent, meaning they could become any type of cell, from branching neurons to dense muscles. Of course, your body needed specific cells in specific places so that your brain and your heart and your muscles would end up in the best spots for those things. So eventually, instructions in your genome told the cells what kind of tissue to permanently become. But before then, Herv H. stepped in. This retrovirus marked your cells as pluripotent and kept them in that state, preventing them from turning into muscle or skin cells for just a little bit longer than they would otherwise. This likely benefits the virus, since the longer the cells stay pluripotent, the more time a virus has to be replicated and infect every cell. But this process might also affect human development. In 2015, researchers were comparing the genomes of humans and macaque monkeys, and they found a few identical genes in both species. But they also noticed that those genes were only expressed in humans while the embryo was pluripotent. In other words, the body was only reading those genes and following their instructions during that stage. It's not exactly clear what the implications are there, but if HERV H is keeping cells pluripotent for longer, it means those genes are expressed longer too. The fact that a random virus could hold an embryo like this is kind of a big deal. That's not a small impact. And HERV H might have other consequences too, like it might play a role in disease. It's still preliminary work, but in 2018, one paper found evidence that this retrovirus could have a role in shaping heart cell development, maybe even a role in heart disease. So one way or another, your body might not quite be the same if it weren't for HERV H. Now, even once your cells were on their way to specialization, they still had months of growing to do, which carried some risk. Like an infection could have easily come along and wiped out your little clump of cells, but it didn't. Maybe thanks to another endogenous retrovirus called HERV-K. Among other things, HERV-K helps embryos develop a built-in immune system that keeps them safe even before they develop antibodies to pathogens in the outside world. It codes for a small protein called REC, and REC helps HERV-K make viral copies and proteins so it can infect other cells. And that might sound like bad news for us, because it seems like the last thing an embryo probably needs is a bunch of virus particles, but in reality, this is actually really useful for embryos. These particles trigger embryonic cells to start making antiviral proteins, and that builds one of its first defenses against other viruses. This kind of thing is far from a complete immune system, but for an embryo, it might make the difference between getting an infection or not. And who knows, maybe this even made a big difference for you once upon a time. So endogenous retroviruses affected your pluripotency, and they helped you with your immunity as an embryo, but they also played a major role in helping you develop into a fully grown fetus. About a week after fertilization, a human embryo is a hollow ball of cells that starts attaching to the uterus. At this time in development, humans, just like all other mammals, will develop a placenta, a temporary organ that forms during pregnancy. This structure is crucial for human pregnancy. It provides nutrition to the developing fetus and helps it get rid of waste. But for it to work, it needs to be connected to the fetus. Now, I know that sounds obvious, but like somehow a mechanism had to evolve to do that job. And as it turns out, an endogenous retrovirus might have played a big role there. Researchers have found that the placenta secretes a protein that binds it to the embryo, keeping the two attached for the next few months of development. And the DNA that makes up that protein is nearly identical to a region of a retrovirus that allows the virus to attach to its host cell. I'm definitely not saying that fetuses are basically like viruses attached to a host, but this does suggest that without this retrovirus, placentas might not work, or at least might not work the same way. So, HERVs shape how your body develops and how it stays protected and cared for during development, but these things don't stop being important as soon as you're born. They have real impact on your adult body, too. For example, endogenous retroviruses didn't just help your embryonic immune systems, they help defend your adult body from pathogens as well. In fact, some research suggests that all of our existing immune system pathways depend on enzymes created by retroviruses and things like them. If you think about it, it's kind of amazing. The remnants of ancient viruses are protecting our bodies against microbes and other viruses. HERVs have a role beyond the immune system, though. They're also responsible for small but significant changes in how the human body works in general. Take this enzyme called amylase. All mammals have it in their pancreas, and it's used to break down complex sugars into simple sugars. But a few mammals, including humans, have it in their saliva. This could be thanks to a retrovirus called HERV-E, which may have converted one of the genes that codes for amylase in our pancreas into a salivary gland version. This isn't just a weird quirk either. Although it's not confirmed, one hypothesis suggests this salivary amylase might help us taste sugary foods better and identify good sources of nutrition. So it could play a big role in your everyday life. Scientists are always interested in learning more about endogenous retroviruses because they can tell us a lot about why humans look and act like humans. But these days, they're also interested in how we can use HERVs to understand specific diseases. For example, some evidence suggests that HERV-W might be involved in multiple sclerosis, and HERV-K might contribute to the pathway that leads to ALS. These things are just now being investigated, but scientists hope that understanding these viruses will eventually lead to cures for both of these neurological diseases. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. At the end of the day, human genetics are complicated, and there are a lot of variables that shaped our species and our adaptations. So the next time you taste a sugary food, recover from a cold, or hear that a friend delivered a healthy baby, well, you might have some ancient viruses to thank.
Turns out, viruses can do a whole lot more than just make us sick. After the initial infection, they can keep having life-changing effects. Sometimes that means HERVs help you develop a placenta so you can deliver a healthy baby, and other times it means COVID might give you cancer. If you haven't heard about that side effect yet, here's how it happens.
I have two problems with the title of this video. First, things don't really cause cancer. Like, imagine the most carcinogenic thing you can. Hopefully, you are currently imagining smoking a cigarette because that is the most cancer-causing thing humans do. Most people who smoke cigarettes for their whole lives will never get lung cancer. Now, their risk is dramatically increased, and also there are a ton of other bad health outcomes, so like, don't smoke cigarettes. But in the strictest sense, things do not cause cancer. Our bodies are too smart for that. Things increase our risk of cancer. Second, since being diagnosed with a cancer myself, I've been working hard not to refer to cancers as a single disease. We really shouldn't be saying cancer, we should be saying cancers. So, the title of this video should probably be more like, does infection with the SARS-CoV-2 virus increase subsequent risk of malignant carcinomas? Or, if we wanted to be brief, is SARS-CoV-2 oncogenic? But fewer of you would have clicked on that, and this is super important information, so we're doing what we're doing. Why is it important? Well, because regardless of how you ask the question, it's starting to look like the answer is yeah, COVID might increase your chances of getting cancer. But before you break out into a cold sweat, there is a lot of complexity that you should know about that simple answer. Just to be super upfront about why I want to talk about this, it's because as soon as COVID might cause cancer becomes a common idea, it's going to be followed by an absolute buttload of misinformation. So what I want to do is less establish whether COVID for sure causes cancer and more show how we're going to be able to recognize that this is the case and how much it's gonna matter. Even though I just said nothing causes cancer, some viruses tiptoe right up to that line. Human papillomavirus, or HPV, has a strong link to cervical cancer and other cancers. The HPV vaccine has dramatically reduced the rates of cervical cancers in places where it is commonly administered. So this would definitely not be the first time a virus caused a cancer. That's actually extremely common. Worldwide, around 10% of cancers would not have occurred without a virus kicking them off. The cancer I was diagnosed with, Hodgkin lymphoma, is caused in part by infection with Epstein-Barr virus, which is the virus that causes mononucleosis. And a lot of you might have just gotten worried, like, oh man, mono? I've had mono, I must be doomed. But more than 90% of Americans are infected with Epstein-Barr virus at some point in their lives, and only 0.2% will get Hodgkin lymphoma. Our statistical and biochemical understandings are sophisticated enough that we were able to first start to understand that link back in the 1970s, which is pretty amazing. But the risk of getting Hodgkin lymphoma doesn't peak until 4 or 5 years after initial infection. And with HPV, it can be 15 or 20 years between initial infection and the onset of cancer. At the moment, No one is 10 or 20 years out from a SARS-CoV-2 infection because it's only been out there in the world for 4 years. And that's a problem, because if there is a connection between COVID-19 and any kind of cancer, we'd have to watch people get sick with COVID and then develop a particular kind of cancer. That's a waiting game, which is no fun for anyone, the scientists or the patients. But it's important to say, so far, we haven't seen an increase in cancers that would be easily explained by COVID. If the effect were super fast and super big, we might be able to have seen it by now, but we also can't just look at people who got a serious COVID infection and see if they were more likely to get cancer. Because look, a person who gets a serious COVID infection might very well develop cancer afterward, because likely the biggest risk factor for a serious case of COVID and the biggest risk factor for cancer are the same thing. Age. Lots of things could increase both the risk of a serious case of COVID and the risk of cancer, and it's very hard to tease out all of those details. But there is one thing we can do to try to peer into the future and see if there's a causal connection between COVID and cancer. There is some limited evidence for genetic risk factors that increase your susceptibility to COVID. And those genetic risk factors, if they exist, would not increase your risk of getting cancer. They would only increase your susceptibility to COVID infection. So, you can look at a very large population and see that folks with those suspected genetic risk factors for COVID have a higher chance of getting COVID. And then you can look at that same population and see if people with those same risk factors have gotten more cancers in the last few years. This type of study is called a Mendelian randomization study, after that guy with the pea plants, and it's sort of a shortcut to figuring out causal links between risk factors and disease outcomes. And we did find one that claimed to have found a causal link between COVID and cancer, but it wasn't, like, a great study. The study calculated the odds ratio of the increased risk of cancer. And this is a measurement that tells you how likely a certain exposure, in this case COVID, is to be related to a certain outcome, in this case a cancer. An odds ratio of 1 means it's basically 50-50. No association between the two things. Odds ratios can go below 1. That means that something decreases the risk of something else. On the other hand, the higher they go above 1, the higher the risk. This paper only reported 1 odds ratio above 2, and that was for stomach cancer. The odds ratio for an association between infection with the virus and stomach cancer was about 2.9. And even that is kind of low. Like, the odds ratio for cigarettes and lung cancer is around 8 at minimum, and that's for people who've ever touched a cigarette, not heavy smokers. So these odds ratios just aren't enough to get worked up about yet. There is another way to look at this, though, and one that is actually easier to investigate at this early stage where we don't have many years of cancer data. Basically, we can, like, pull the virus apart and ask whether it's doing anything likely to tip our cells toward cancer, which doesn't for sure answer the question, but it lets us keep an eye out. So the first question to ask, then, is why do viruses cause cancer at all? And the answer is, because it helps them. Some viruses are pretty brute force. It's the traditional virus story. They turn your cells into virus factories until your cell realizes something is wrong and blows itself up. And then more virus particles get released into your body to infect more cells. But other viruses have evolved to keep some of your cells alive as little viral reservoirs. This is what HPV does. Your cells have all kinds of ways to check for damage and then send out a signal for the cell to destroy itself if things look weird. But that would be bad for the virus. So HPV has evolved ways to dampen the cell's ability to check for DNA damage and to destroy itself. That means a longer-lived, more active reservoir for viruses. But one of the main traits of a cancer is that it is a group of cells in your body that are worse at repairing DNA and good at conveniently ignoring orders to destroy themselves. So the virus has evolved in order to do what is good for the virus, but that also just happens to take a cell a few steps closer to potentially becoming cancerous, which increases your individual risk and also increases the total number of cancers in a population of people. The question is then, does the SARS-CoV-2 virus mess with cells in this way? And yeah, it's starting to look like it does. One of the most important tumor-suppressing genes in your body is P53. It does exactly what we've been talking about. It helps your cells check DNA for damage and can signal a cell to destroy itself if things are looking weird. People who inherit only one functional copy of this gene from their parents are extremely likely to get multiple cancers early in their lives. Researchers have observed that SARS-CoV-2 has been shown to lower the amount amount of P53 in a person's cells. In one 2022 report, researchers looked at blood samples from COVID patients with mild, moderate, severe, or critical infections, including some with long COVID. In patients with mild or moderate infections, their blood had lower levels of P53 16 weeks after infection, but it bounced back by 24 weeks. But patients with severe or critical infections didn't have that bounce back. Their P53 levels were still low after 24 weeks. And it's not just low, it's actually worryingly low. The researchers specified that if the reduction in P53 function continues, it could be just as bad as a mutation that causes it to lose function. Less P53 means that the cells are less able to fight the COVID infection, but it also means that they've been pushed a little further down the path to potentially becoming a cancer. A brief dip in P53 levels probably isn't anything to worry about, but the longer you go without, the more the risk of cancer increases. But while P53 is a big deal, there's plenty more that might be going on here too. For example, the SARS-CoV-2 virus interferes with something called the RAS system, which regulates blood pressure and results in increased activity of a protein called angiotensin II. Angiotensin II is itself associated with more aggressive cases of a certain type of lung cancer, but it also can switch on all kinds of pro-growth signals that cancer cells slurp up like candy. On top of that, infection with the virus appears to disrupt normal cell division, causing mutations and pushing cells to divide even when normal checks and balances would stop them. Based on the molecular pathways it alters and the organs it affects, researchers suggest we should keep a particular eye out for lung, colorectal, pancreatic, breast, and oral cancers. At this point, it is looking like it is possible that the SARS-CoV-2 virus increases the risk of certain cancers. But there are much more important, bigger questions that remain unanswered. Like what's actually going to happen, when, and to whom? We live every day with almost everyone in this country getting a cancer-causing virus, Epstein-Barr, and we simply don't think about that. I mean, I don't. Some people do, though, and a vaccine for that virus could save thousands of lives a year, and there are people working on one, which is great, because Epstein-Barr also increases a person's risk of multiple sclerosis by around 32 times. One last thing here. You may have heard that rates of some cancers among young people, especially colorectal cancer, have been recently increasing. And indeed, rates of colorectal cancer in people between the ages of 35 and 45 have been increasing substantially, basically doubling since 1995. This is a long-term trend, but it only really hit the news in the last few years. We've seen people wondering online if this increase is because of COVID, and we just wanted to add at the end here that this trend significantly predates the emergence of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and the causes of that increase remain unclear. Some of it is probably just because people are getting more FaceTime with their doctors. In fact, right before the pandemic began, a report came out that showed people were spending more time with doctors, and when you spend more time with doctors, you find more diseases and disorders, including cancer. COVID is in some ways the most studied virus in history, but the reality is that we will need more time and more research to understand the significance of the link between COVID and cancers. We've already been able to see rates of cervical cancer decrease after people started getting the HPV vaccine, but that took forever. As with many things in science, the more we know, the more questions we find. And we have not found a dramatic link between COVID and cancer, but we have found a potential link. It's not cigarettes, but is it nothing? Let's put it somewhere between cigarettes and nothing. And drilling deep on this virus has been extremely effective in helping us better understand cellular and viral phenomena. But it might also help us understand our bodies more broadly and the diseases that befall them. Knowing more is always good, even if what we find is not as comforting as we might like.
Yep, it's official. I hate COVID. If there weren't enough reasons before, that's another one. And I certainly wouldn't want to repeat that whole global pandemic thing anytime soon, which is why we had to make this somewhat foreboding video guest hosted by Pardis about what might be the next global pandemic, the bird flu.
Sometime in the 1990s, an Indonesian crime lord named Panteng Ginteng made a deal with a demon. He asked for wealth and power, and his wish was granted. But instead of paying up, he stiffed the demon. In 2006, though Panteng was already deceased, members of his family began to fall ill with a mysterious affliction. Local magical practitioners consulted the spirits, and their message was clear. It was time to pay the piper. Seven members of the family, they said, would be claimed by the vengeful demon. Though some of them received state-of-the-art hospital care, others distrusted medical authorities and sought out local ritual experts instead. After all, who was better at dealing with demons? But the medical authorities feared a different cause: H5N1 influenza. bird flu. As some of the Gintengs fled to the remote hills of Sumatra, responders raced to keep up, isolating their contacts and testing for the presence of the virus. Only one of the Gintengs had been closely exposed to infected birds. That meant this could be the big one, a strain of avian influenza that could spread from person to person. At the time, bird flu was known to kill up to 60% of those it infected. If the responders failed to contain the outbreak, a pandemic could claim the lives of 1 billion people. Fortunately, the outbreak fizzled. Exactly 7 of the Gintengs died, just as predicted. The antiviral drug Tamiflu was distributed to the Gintengs' close contacts, but many of them declined to take it. To them, the demon explanation was sufficient. After all, no birds were obviously sick, and no one outside of the Ginteng family had fallen ill. Pontin had tampered with supernatural forces he should have left alone. It just made sense. The Ginteng story tells us two things. One, that people tend to act rationally according to their own beliefs, not according to what experts want them to do. And two, that the next flu pandemic is just one stroke of bad luck away. Seasonal flu alone kills 500,000 people every year. The next pandemic, if it's H5N1, could kill many times that number. Bird flu is out there. In fact, it's increasingly out there. While it's impossible to know when and where a pandemic will begin, bird flu is getting more and more chances to make it happen. Eventually, it's going to figure it out. My name is Pardis Sabetti, and I'm a professor of infectious disease at Harvard University. Among other things, I study how to combat emerging infectious diseases like bird flu. However we respond to H5N1, those tools will be the ones we have to use against the next pandemic flu and the one after that. Will we vanquish bird flu and everything that comes next? Or will we be complacent and allow many millions to be lost? Here's why bird flu is almost inevitable and what we can do about it. The Ginteng family believed that a demon was responsible for their illness. But if you'll allow us a metaphor, maybe it's not all that strange to think of the flu as a demon. One that's out to get all of us. One that's dogged us for much of recorded history, shifting its shape to strike in different forms. This demon is clever, so to outwit it, we need to understand how it operates. In the case of H5N1 avian flu, we know exactly what needs to happen for it to become able to easily infect humans.
This is a virus that's so very, very much a bird virus, right? So, you know, it's not a virus that certainly infects humans very well, doesn't transmit between humans. And so this virus has got to change. You know, it's got to change in a way that switches it from preferring to replicating in birds to preferring to replicate in humans for a pandemic to occur.
That's Dr. Richard Webby, a virologist and expert in host microbe interactions at St. Jude's Children's Hospital. And because H5N1 is infecting more and more birds and animals every year, we also know that it's getting more and more chances to achieve the changes it needs to easily infect humans.
Viruses have lots of mutational options to them, and they produce a gazillion of themselves, and so they explore the full range of their genetic possibilities, often in every infection that they have. And so, you know, we're basically giving them lots of shots on goal as we're giving them opportunities to infect people.
That's Dr. Gigi Granval, a professor at Johns Hopkins University and an expert in pandemic preparedness. We'll be hearing more from both of these experts later. Basically, H5N1 is a problem because it's everywhere. It's infecting wild birds on nearly every continent, giving it lots of opportunities to cross over to humans. And when it does, it can be incredibly bad. So how did the demon get to this point? First, let's look at its history. In the year 412 BCE, the father of medicine himself, Hippocrates, treated patients with symptoms of influenza, and it's only picked up steam since then. The historical record is patchy for a long time after that, but the first recorded flu pandemic, where the disease spreads over a wide area, likely occurred sometime in the 16th century. And since the start of the 20th century, we've had flu pandemics in 1918, 1957, 1968, and 2009. In other words, we're under regular assault by this demon, and the H5N1 flu virus is one of its most frightening faces. Every flu virus has 8 genes, a crack team of 8 minions, each with their own specialty. Whenever you hear flu referred to as H number, N number, that's in reference to 2 of its key minions, hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. Hemagglutinin is the most important one for our purposes today. It's the team's safecracker. It recognizes a type of sugar molecule on the surface of cells called sialic acid and uses that to break the virus in. In the normal seasonal flu you might get, the safecracker is either H1 or H3. Both are experts in breaking and entering in human cells. H5 specializes in infiltrating bird cells. If it stays that way, that's good for us, albeit not great for birds.
One of the biggest host range barriers between avian hosts and human hosts is the sugars that this virus likes to bind to. So it's a virus, it's got to get inside a cell to replicate. Flu viruses bind to a sialic acid sugar on the surface of the cell. They bind to that, and then that gets the virus inside the cell. In avian hosts, that particular sialic acid in a slightly different form than what is most common in humans.
Basically, a slight chemical difference between bird cell sugars and human cell sugars is what keeps H5N1 out. If H5 ever learns the trick to consistently breaking in using human sugars instead, we're in for a bad time. Our immune systems have seen H1 and H3 before, and they know what to do. But almost no one's immune system has ever met an H5, as far as we know. But every once in a while, H5 can just barely get its foot in the door. Let me show you what happens when it does. But as a warning, we'll be talking about the death of a young child. Sometime around 1996 in southern China, the influenza virus learned to take on a new form in birds. In 1997, a 3-year-old boy named Lam Hoi Ka played with some baby birds at a school in Hong Kong. Did your kindergarten teacher ever bring in an incubator and let you watch baby chicks hatch? It might have been something like that. 5 days later, the child was dead. His lungs were ravaged, but so were his kidneys, his liver, and even his blood. As far as we know, he was the first human victim of H5N1 avian flu. Authorities raced to find the cause, but when they did, they couldn't believe their eyes. Bird flu wasn't supposed to infect humans. It wasn't supposed to be possible. Yet more cases began to spring up. In total, 18 infections would be detected, with 6 dead. Eventually, the authorities ordered a drastic step.
That particular virus was probably born within the live poultry markets in Hong Kong. It was born within those systems, within the chickens and ducks and other species in those markets. So when the authorities in Hong Kong decided to depopulate all of those birds, they got rid of that particular form of the H5 virus. Unfortunately, the precursors and close cousins of that virus were still circulating in southern China.
That is to say, killing virtually all of Hong Kong's poultry stopped the 1997 outbreak, but it didn't destroy the demon virus at its source. It would strike again. So why was this first outbreak so scary? It's not just that our immune systems don't know what to do with H5. It's that so far, by flu standards, H5 is especially deadly and causes especially severe disease. Beginning with the 1997 outbreak, H5N1 has had a case fatality rate as high as 60%. That is, 60% of cases detected resulted in death. Keep that figure in mind, though, because we're going to need it later. If you extrapolate that number to a global pandemic, and if you assume that the virus doesn't get milder as it gets better at jumping between humans, you end up with an unimaginable global crisis of 1 billion people dead. Now, that is a hair on fire, worst case scenario for a few reasons. One, the case fatality rate can't account for infections that aren't detected. And there are definitely infections that go undetected. Those undetected cases are likely to be the ones that are less severe. So the real case fatality rates usually get lower with more detection. Two, viruses can get milder as they begin to transmit more efficiently among the population. So a bird flu pandemic probably wouldn't kill 1 billion people, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't be really bad.
So certainly not going to be 60%, I can almost guarantee that, but no, I do think it would probably be the worst flu pandemic that we have recorded.
Dr. Webby told us that that's because the virus still has plenty of capacity to cause severe disease. It's really difficult to try and guess what the actual case fatality rate might be, with some experts putting it at more like 15 to 30%. Keep in mind that even a 1% case fatality rate would be a completely awful thing to have happen. COVID-19 hovered around a 1% fatality rate in the United States prior to 2023, and everyone still remembers how horrible that was. The 1918 flu was proportionally deadlier. Its case fatality rate was 2.5%. Basically, even if H5 isn't as deadly as we think it could be, it's still the deadliest version of influenza we've ever encountered. After the 1997 outbreak, health authorities all over Southeast Asia were on high alert for this threat. And in 2003, the alarm bell sounded in Hong Kong once again. In late 2002, a mysterious respiratory disease was causing deaths in Guangdong Province, China. Though the Chinese government initially tried to downplay this outbreak, it reached Hong Kong in 2003. H5N1 was known to be circulating in wild birds at the time, and several human cases had cropped up. The natural question experts asked themselves was this the beginning of the long-feared bird flu pandemic? As it turned out, no. This wasn't bird flu or a flu at all. This was a demon of a different kind, a type of virus thought to be mostly harmless, called a coronavirus. And yet the disease caused by this coronavirus, called SARS, killed in similar ways to flu, by causing a storm in the lungs known as acute respiratory distress syndrome. SARS required similar healthcare responses to severe influenza, like ventilators and hospital beds. And SARS spread in similar ways to flu, though a bit less readily. That means that although it wasn't flu, SARS was a stress test for how we would handle an outbreak of a disease similar to flu. So Dr. Granval, how did we do?
We did not learn enough from SARS. We saw that there was this zoonotic spillover from animals to people. That's the way more than three quarters of new infectious diseases come about. We never did develop a vaccine. We never did really develop tests for it. What we did learn is that these things can happen and that public health can contain it if we're lucky.
And we did contain it. The SARS pandemic ended with only about 8,500 cases, of which about 11% were fatal. The outbreak was stopped before it could get any worse thanks to old-fashioned, boots-on-the-ground epidemiology. What I mean by that is finding cases, finding who they've been in contact with, and isolating them before it's too late. That's contact tracing, the thing we kept hearing about during COVID. SARS proved that it really can work. And yet, hospitals and healthcare workers were overwhelmed in places with the worst outbreaks. So we didn't exactly pass our stress test with flying colors. While we were earning that C, maybe a B minus, the threat of bird flu was growing stronger. As I mentioned, the safecracker that is H5 needs to undergo some very specific changes to be able to infect humans more easily, as well as to spread from person to person. But the more opportunities it gets, the more likely that is to happen. And several times in the 2000s, it came terrifyingly close. Once again, we're going to tell a very sad story here. It's the tragic case of an 11-year-old Thai girl named Sakuntala Prampasi. Around August of 2004, the chickens in her rural village all sickened and died. Within a few days, Sakuntala herself fell ill. Though she was taken to a hospital for treatment, nobody guessed bird flu. Eventually, she was admitted for pneumonia. Prani Tongcheng, her mother, was a garment worker whose job was 200 miles away. When she heard the news, she did what any mother would do and rushed to the girl's bedside. We can only imagine what she went through as she cradled the girl in her arms for the last hours of her life. Yet things were about to take another turn. As Prani attempted to return to work, she too fell ill. Not only had she already gone through the very worst thing a mother can, the disease would take her life too. Prani is considered one of the first certain cases of human-to-human transmission of H5N1. Her occupation didn't put her into contact with birds that could make her sick, but she was in very close contact with Sakuntala. Imagine if in the depths of her grief, as she tried to move on with her life and her job, one of her coworkers had caught the disease from her, and it had spread from there. It's worth noting that Prani's sister Pranam also got sick, but she was given the antiviral drug Tamiflu and recovered. That brings us back to 2006, to Panten Gintig, his supernatural dealings, and his children. The eldest daughter, Pooji, was the first to fall ill, possibly through exposure to poultry next to the market stall where she worked. It appears six other family members caught the disease from Pooji. Only after that does it appear that one of the sons, Dawes, caught the virus from one of them. He developed the symptoms so much later than everyone else that it's unlikely for him to have gotten it from Pooji directly. In other words, this outbreak represented transmission from person to person and then to another person, something that had not been seen before. Fortunately, it stopped there. A local ritual expert claimed to have protected the remaining family members from black magic by creating a protective boundary around them. The only remaining son, Jonas, became gravely ill, but recovered. And residents of the community, knowing full well of the patriarch Ponten's dealing with demons, blamed black magic for the illness, not influenza. They refused to take Tamiflu when it was given to them. I want to emphasize that this isn't foolish behavior, not according to the way these people understand the world. In public health, it's important to try to reach people where they are, not convince them they're wrong. Otherwise, they made distressed efforts to help even more. We'll come back to that idea. In both of these outbreaks, we can see two main tools being used. One is contact tracing, the other is oseltamivir, an antiviral drug sold under the brand name Tamiflu. Oseltamivir works by blocking the activity of neuraminidase, one of those other minion genes we talked about. It's given to manage symptoms in patients who are already having bad cases of flu. It can also be used to try to prevent flu symptoms from developing. Now that all sounds great, and at the time of these outbreaks, it was believed to be one of the best weapons for fighting the influenza virus. However, since then, support for the use of oseltamivir has declined slightly. One mega review in 2013 suggested that neuraminidase inhibitors like oseltamivir don't do much in terms of preventing symptoms in otherwise healthy people, at least not enough to be worth the side effects, or the virus potentially evolving resistance to the drugs. Yet these drugs do seem to be great for avoiding death in severe cases and shortening the duration of symptoms, at least when it comes to seasonal flu. And the CDC recommends using oseltamivir for post-exposure prophylaxis in folks who have been exposed to bird flu. So we haven't thrown it out the window, but at the same time, we probably need to concentrate on multiple strategies to make sure we're ready for the next time the demon strikes, which it did in 2009.
The 2009 H1N1 pandemic was pretty unexpected. Everybody had for years been preparing for H5N1, and it was going to be coming from Asia, Southeast Asia, perhaps, but definitely, you know, somewhere not around the United States.
The 2009 so-called swine flu originated in North America. It was an H1N1 virus, which happens to employ the same two primary minion genes as the devastating 1918 flu pandemic. And while this H1N1 wasn't the same virus, it had some things in common with it. Three viral lineages, including one descended from the 1918 strain, all infected pigs. They held a sort of genetic white elephant gift exchange and emerged as a novel virus just unfamiliar enough to our immune systems to trigger a new pandemic. You might remember the swine flu as having been mild, but the demon is cruel and mild is relative. Even as the disease spared older people, which is uncommon for flu, it was devastating in pregnant people.
And at the time, I was pregnant and just anxiously awaiting the vaccine and eventually was able to get it. But I had the fun experience of having my OB tell me, because he knew me as a professional as well as, you know, as being my doctor, say, "Oh, we lost another healthy woman last week to H1N1.
The 1918 flu was also especially dangerous in those who were pregnant. So perhaps the 2009 version inherited that tendency from the older virus. We may also be able to explain why the 2009 flu spared seniors, which has implications for bird flu. There's a concept in immunology called original antigenic sin. This somewhat poetic name basically just means you never forget your first flu. And depending on how old you are, your first flu might be different than someone else's. See, after the flu successfully causes a pandemic, it doesn't just kick its heels up and retire. Rather, it embeds itself in the human population, spreading in seasonal waves around the world. Pandemic flu becomes seasonal flu. That means if you were born between 1918 and 1957, your first flu was H1N1. Between 1957 and 1968, it was H2N2. After 1968, it was H3N2. And of course, H1N1 is now circulating as well, so it can be either one. As soon as the 2009 pandemic broke out, researchers speculated that anyone born prior to 1957 might have some immune protection against H1N1. And while it's not 100% certain, the idea does seem to be supported by the evidence. One group of researchers has applied this concept to bird flu. They were studying two types, H5N1 and another avian flu, H7N9. And they noticed a strange age distribution in which patients got infected with which flu. Specifically, H7N9 is more dangerous in patients who were born before 1968, and H5N1 is more dangerous than those born after. The researchers suggest that for some reason, the H1 circulating prior to 1968 seemed to provide some protection from H5. That explained why older folks were less vulnerable to H5. Meanwhile, H3 may promote some protection against H7, hence why younger people were more vulnerable to H5 but less so to H7. This does provide a glimmer of hope, especially with H1 circulating again. We might not be quite as defenseless against H5 as we thought, which is good, because here in the 2020s, the demon is closing in. You might recall a very different respiratory disease pandemic that occurred beginning in 2019. In fact, you might be wondering why we're so worried about flu when the big one hit and it wasn't flu at all. Well, it's because just like with SARS, how we responded to COVID-19 sheds light on how we might respond to the next flu pandemic.
I think we would be more stretched thin during a flu pandemic now than we were during COVID, because there has been less interest in going into public health. At first, there was a big surge, and then that has leveled off. I think that there is even more dissonance in the public sphere of how people think about public health. And so I think that it's going to be hard to get expert messages across. So I think it really all depends. You know, I mean, I think people, good leadership can really try to turn this around, consistent public health communication can help, but there are negative forces that really make it a lot harder than it needs to be.
We did learn a few important things from COVID-19. We developed testing, and we even turned around vaccines in record time. COVID-19 also showed that we can share data and scientific insights way faster than we could in the past. Rather than waiting to publish formally in a journal, a scientist can upload a paper to a preprint server, and another scientist halfway around the world can read it the same day. But we learned a lot of other stuff too, about how easily hospitals can run out of beds and ventilators. To put it mildly, we also learned that misinformation can spread quickly, and that it can affect people's behavior. We learn that people won't always act purely in the interest of protecting others, nor will they defer to experts just because they're experts. So you might say COVID has helped us a lot in preparing for a flu pandemic, but there's another side to that coin. Many of us are just tired of thinking about pandemics, and that fatigue causes things to break down just when they need to be at their strongest.
I think we have some of the elements in place, but I worry that our diagnostic testing is not quite up to where it needs to be. We had recommended a lot more interaction between the private sector and government public health to be able to roll out diagnostic tests more quickly. And I'm not sure that we're there yet. So I think the lesson is that you can't let systems wither and deteriorate so that you can't ramp them up.
We're tired and we're distracted. Unfortunately, us not wanting a pandemic to break out doesn't mean the demon will politely wait until we're ready. While we were all distracted by COVID-19, it made its move. During the 2010s, it kind of seemed like H5N1 had gone quiet. Nobody talked much about bird flu then, but it was an illusion.
Didn't cause a lot of outbreaks in poultry, and you know, there wasn't a lot of human infections either. But we also got to, when we talk about activity with this virus, we've also got to remember that surveillance, meaning actively going out and looking for this virus, hasn't been constant throughout all this time as well. So some of that dip in activity in the 2010s, you know, some of it's probably reduced to a little bit of lack of funding over that time period to go out and actively look for the virus. So a little bit of virus changes over that time, probably a little bit of circulation without us even knowing.
H5N1 was slowly spreading through its native hosts, wild birds. As early as 2005, researchers realized this was going to be a problem. You see, birds are well known for their ability to fly. Even though the early outbreaks we've talked about were all in southern or southeast Asia, H5N1 didn't stay there for long. It spread to the rest of Asia and North Africa, where it's been especially troublesome in Egypt. From there, it traveled to Europe and settled in all across all of Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Then in 2021, something changed. The expert safecracker, H5, evolved a new set of tools that made it even better at getting into bird cells. And that allowed bird flu to spread explosively all around the globe. 2344B doesn't sound like a compelling name for a villain. If you were a film producer, you'd send that one back to the writer's room. Yet H5s belonging to the subgroup called clade 2344B have taken over the world. It's spread aggressively among wild birds, quickly outcompeting and replacing older H5s. And it's spread further than any other H5 avian flu that's come before. It's now endemic in Europe, meaning it's embedded in the local population, rather than coming through as migrating birds bring it with them. And while it's not yet endemic in North and South America, at the time we're making this at the end of 2024, it's very much here and causing serious problems. Since 2022, this demon virus, with its robotic new name, has been showing up in a troubling number of mammals. Among other things, it's been ravaging populations of seals in South America. It does not seem like it's worked out how to spread between mammals easily, other than the seals, which is good news for us humans. Rather, these infections seem to be happening because there's just so much virus around in wild birds.
When we look at the virus, this current batch of H5s and their ability to infect mammals, it doesn't seem to be that much different than other H5s that have come, you know, over the past 25 years. So again, my gut feeling is that we're seeing more mammals infected with this virus simply because there are many more infected birds, sick, dying birds that, you know, fall out of the sky, and along comes a fox or a skunk or name your scavenging mammal. You know, they take a big old bite of that infected bird and get a huge dose of virus and get sick themselves.
And because the virus was out there in the wild birds, there was plenty of opportunity for domesticated birds to come into contact with them and become sick themselves. In 2022, migrating wild birds in the spring and fall caused outbreaks in domesticated fowl in the United States. These outbreaks required the killing of tens of millions of birds. And this is a real thing we have to think about when we're fighting back against the demon. Bird flu is so deadly in birds that entire flocks have to be culled if infection is detected. That also has real economic costs to people. If you live in the United States and you're not a vegan, the virus has probably already affected your life by driving up the price of eggs, an important source of cheap vegetarian protein. That year also saw the United States' very first human case of H5N1 in a farm worker involved in carrying out those poultry culls. Fortunately, the individual experienced mild symptoms and recovered. That brings us to the present day, and I'm sorry to say, the demon appears to be at our doorstep. More outbreaks among poultry have resulted in more cullings and more infections in humans, but there's a weird twist. Cows are getting bird flu. They're not getting it from chickens by and large, though they are giving it to chickens. It seems like a single spillover from wild birds is now spreading among dairy cattle in the United States. And because there's not really a system in place for testing and isolating cattle, and because cattle are transported all over the country, it's spread to multiple herds and multiple states. I won't quote an exact number because it will definitely change by the time you see this. When we were finalizing the research for this video at the end of 2024, there had been at least 58 confirmed or reported cases of bird flu in humans in the US. But again, that number is likely to be higher by the time you're watching this. You can go to the CDC's website for up-to-date info. A common infection route seems to be dairy workers getting milk splashed in their eyes. The good news is that, again, knock on wood, and we have a really long production schedule. Zero of those people have died so far. And yet, I told you that H5N1 kills somewhere between 15 and 60% of its victims. This gap needs explaining, and no one has an answer for why. The route of infection seems to be one potential reason. The individuals who've been infected by getting splashed in the eyes tend to show symptoms in, well, their eyes. Many have no symptoms other than conjunctivitis. We do know that the H5 safecracker can sometimes break into the cells of the eye, so that's no big surprise. But the fact that it's not causing much mischief in the lungs is definitely a relief. It's also possible that just getting splashed with some milk doesn't give you a large enough amount of the virus to make you really sick.
Maybe it's infection route. If you're a fox or a bear or a mountain lion and you sort of chomp into a heavily infected bird, you're getting lots of virus in the nose, lots of virus in the mouth. Whereas perhaps on those, on a milking parlor and a dairy cow herd or in a flock of chickens, maybe it's more aerosolized and landing on the conjunctiva in the eye, landing in the very extremities of the nasal passages. Maybe it's a dose. Again, if you give a higher dose, maybe you get more severe disease.
The reason we're seeing mild disease isn't totally clear. It might seem like the demon has lost its fangs, but scientists can clearly see that's not the case.
It's something that I wouldn't say exactly keeps me up at night, but it's something I scratch my head about a lot. Why is there all these signals that saying this is a really, 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 really nasty virus, but at the same time not causing much disease in the people in the US?
Because outside of the US, cases caused by the same 2344B-derived virus have been severe. One infection was reported in Ecuador and one in Chile, both in 2023. While neither were fatal, both cause very serious symptoms. And in case you're tempted to chalk the difference up to the US's superior healthcare system, that's not the difference maker here. The farm workers becoming infected in the US sometimes belong to highly vulnerable groups. They may be undocumented, they may not speak English as a first language, and they may not have great access to healthcare. So it's definitely not that. But this is where we are right now. The demon is all around us. It's threatening our food supply, and it's starting to cause infections more and more often. None of those infections have spread from person to person yet that we know about, but given enough opportunities, it will. And to be clear, the US is not the only place where a pandemic could begin. I know we really like to make things all about us. A pandemic could start in South America or Southeast Asia or virtually anywhere, but this cow situation is bizarre, so it makes sense for all eyes to be on us. The question now becomes, how do we fight back? We have tools to fight a bird flu pandemic. Some are low-tech, like getting boots on the ground to do contact tracing, or to monitor herds of cattle, for that matter. Some are more sophisticated, like Tamiflu. And believe it or not, we have vaccines for H5N1. We know enough about how to make a flu vaccine to make one for H5 that we can be pretty confident will work. And scientists can keep an eye on it in case that changes. A universal flu vaccine is another option. The hunt for something like that is intense and ongoing. It's so intense that it's too much to go into, even in a video this long. So in summary, they're working on it. Other high-tech tools could also come into play. mRNA vaccines, like the ones developed during the COVID-19 pandemic, could certainly have a place. But to limit speculation, I'd like to focus on what we could do right now. Supplies of H5N1 vaccine are limited, but it's hard to see why we shouldn't use them to protect the people we already know are vulnerable. Poultry and dairy workers.
When it comes to how we handle the current H5N1 dairy cow crisis, and we have to do things the right way. You have to try to do things to avoid stigma for the people who are at most risk. You need to have supportive medical care for those people and explain what the potential risks are. You also can't just put everything on them, and I think they should be offered flu vaccines and H5N1 vaccines when we get them. But we need to be doing much more surveillance of the dairy cows as well.
By the way, the US CDC is offering free seasonal flu vaccines to farm workers in the states most affected. Getting vaccinated against seasonal flu probably won't prevent them from getting bird flu, but it can reduce the burden of seasonal flu in case bird flu cases start to pile up. Unfortunately, getting enough bird flu vaccine in hand could be a challenge. Sometimes the economic incentives around preparing for a pandemic can be stubborn.
We could spend, you know, millions to billions of dollars making H5 vaccine now, and never, ever, ever have an H5 pandemic. So it's tough. But at the same time, you know, the potential consequences of H5 pandemic are terrible. So they're going to be resources well spent either way, in my mind anyway.
Whether with vaccines or something else, we have a responsibility to protect these farm workers. And what's more, it needs to be now. Not when it seems like a pandemic is already breaking out.
I think now is the time where we should be concentrating on providing those resources, any medical resources, to the people who are most at risk for being infected. We shouldn't be thinking about waiting until there's an actual epidemic forming. We should be concentrating on making sure that the people who are at most risk are most protected. And that includes the people and the animals that are closest to the dairy cows that are infected.
As Dr. Granville told us more than once, we can't make it the responsibility of the vulnerable to prevent a pandemic. We've learned from the Gintings, as well as from countless people during COVID-19, that people will act in a way they believe to be in their own interests. Good science communication and good public health leadership will be crucial. Because as I mentioned, many of the people in most danger in the US are undocumented, are not in a great position to trust the healthcare system. Building trust in public health is hard. Sometimes it's about convincing someone who sincerely believes a malevolent spirit caused their illness that Tamiflu is the best way to protect their community. Sometimes it's about explaining the need to wear eye protection when milking, even though people aren't getting all that sick. It isn't easy, and people will be mistrustful and defensive sometimes because they're people.
And so you have to put structures in place. You have to have leaders who talk about this. You have to make things available, and you have to communicate effectively. And this has been done with variable degrees of success over the last decades.
So vaccines plus monitoring plus good leadership sounds like a recipe for success. Does that mean we're ready for a bird flu pandemic?
We are not ready for a bird flu pandemic. Can we get ready? Absolutely. We're making things a little hard for ourselves. I don't know if this is containable anymore, given the number of herds that are infected. If it turns out that this is nothing, great. But this is a great opportunity for us to get better at figuring out how we can stop something like this. And we should take advantage of that at minimum to be able to stop the chains of infection, to figure out what's causing it, and to protect the people who are most at risk.
We have to act now because, unfortunately, we can't see the future.
I think if we look at that from the current situation we're in, let's think about this virus running through our dairy industry. Are we prepared for that? Have we been prepared for that? Yeah, no, not at all. Yeah, one, from an ability to respond. Two, from sort of having plans in place as to what happens if this virus gets into dairy cows. There is no plans for that because, one, well, this virus doesn't get into dairy cows, so why would you even have a plan for that? And of course it did, so we needed it.
Apparently, we still have some work to do. Fortunately, so does the demon. Despite how close it is, it still needs to figure out human transmission. It's had so many opportunities, but so far, it's failed every single time. We know at a molecular level exactly what would have to change, and it hasn't.
If you look at its ability to grow in different cells and in different hosts, it's still very much an avian virus. So from that perspective, you know, it does have to change quite a bit before it could become human-to-human transmissible. And the fact that it hasn't done so over the past 25 years, you know, despite having lots and lots of opportunities to do so, you know, at least to me, suggests the barrier for this virus to switch from being a bird virus to being a mammal virus, a human virus at least, is probably quite high.
A bird flu pandemic could happen tomorrow, or it could never happen. So why do we say a pandemic is almost inevitable? Well, no one can know that, of course, but it's a matter of opportunity. Nothing guarantees that H5N1 will evolve human-to-human transmission, but its increased presence in wild birds, poultry, cows, and humans is giving it the chance to take as many shots as it likes.
The hardest question to answer is what is the actual risk of this virus? So I can talk in terms of relative risk. So I think in terms of relative risk, we're probably as high as we've ever been with H5 virus, just simply because way, way more exposure of humans to infected animals.
Relative risk is still relative. And in absolute terms, the risk is probably still low. But the problem is that we currently have the perfect conditions for it to happen.
Is H5N1 and these sporadic infections and this ongoing problem with dairy cows, is this going to be the next pandemic? No one can say. What we can say is that there is no other logical path that we know of for how you get to a pandemic than having these infections occur in animals and spill over to people.
We're going to have a lot of choices ahead when it comes to meeting the challenge this influenza virus poses. Some of it is about science and technology, making sophisticated new tools to protect ourselves. Some of it is about leadership and public health, meeting people where they are with the information they need to make good decisions. And some of it is about basic empathy, making sure the people in the most danger are protected, no matter who they are. How we meet the demon in battle will say a lot about ourselves. And just like with SARS, COVID-19, or past influenzas, what we learn will apply to every flu we have to fight in the future. But with science on our side, I'm hopeful it's a fight we'll win.
So, we can get viruses when they hop over to humans from other animals. But those animals don't always have to get sick first. Some pesky little guys like mosquitoes can send a virus right to us without it harming them at all. The weird thing is how mosquitoes can only transmit some viruses, like Zika, but not others like the flu. Here's why.
Are you like most humans? Do you hate mosquitoes? We talk about mosquitoes a lot because they're terrible. They transmit malaria, West Nile virus, and now the Zika virus, among many other pathogens. But what's so special about those diseases that we only get them from mosquito bites? Why can't we get other diseases from mosquitoes? Like, if you have the flu and a mosquito bites you and then bites someone else, why don't they get the flu? Well, the disease-causing organisms that mosquitoes transmit to humans are actually special cases. They evolved to both require an insect and a vertebrate as a part of their life cycle. In fact, this requirement is so specific that each disease can only be carried by specific genera or species of mosquito. For example, only mosquitoes of the genus Aedes can carry the Zika virus. But let's back up a little. There are two main types of mosquito-borne diseases in humans. Malaria is caused by a single-celled protozoan. Most of the others are caused by viruses, known as arthropod-borne viruses, or arboviruses for short. Arboviruses can infect both an arthropod, usually a mosquito or a tick, and a vertebrate, in this case humans. Typically, viruses latch onto host cells by sticking to proteins on them called receptors. If a cell doesn't have the right receptor, the virus can't get in. And arboviruses recognize receptors on both insect and human cells. They can infect them both. So an arbovirus can jump from mosquitoes to humans because it can use the receptors on insect cells to get from a mosquito's stomach to its salivary glands. From there, it can replicate and infect the next human. By contrast, influenza viruses don't have this ability because they can't recognize insect cell receptors. So it's unlikely that it or any regular old virus could get from a mosquito's stomach to a human. The malaria parasite's process is even weirder. It can reproduce both sexually and asexually, but it needs a human and two mosquitoes to do it. First, immature parasites enter the human body through the salivary glands of a mosquito. They mature in the liver and then hijack our red blood cells and divide. This is the asexual part of their life cycle. But some of these parasites, instead of just dividing, produce the precursors to sex cells, like the protozoan version of sperm and eggs. Those then get sucked up by another mosquito. Those proto-sex cells then mature and combine inside the second mosquito, which is the sexual reproduction part, producing new parasites to infect the next person. Which I gotta say is a pretty slick system, but that does not change how I feel about those protozoans, or the mosquitoes they rode in on.
Some viruses are just super well adapted to move around in mosquitoes and infect humans, which has made researchers suggest killing all those mosquitoes, or at least preventing them from making more mosquito babies. Surely there would be no downsides to a world where we get fewer viruses, right? Here's a thought experiment. What if all viruses vanished?
So viruses have kind of been on everyone's minds lately. Sure, before COVID-19, we had to deal with viruses that ranged from merely inconvenient to devastating. But after what has been a truly rotten time for everyone, if someone were to come across a supernatural wish-granting creature, you might want to wish for all viruses to disappear in the past, present, and in the future. Yeah, absolutely no one would believe your story, but at least everyone would be free of viral misery. But based on what we know about viruses, it could be more of a monkey's paw situation. By sheer numbers, viruses are considered the most abundant biological entities on Earth. That's a lot to just wish away. So we're gonna take a look at the science and try to imagine what the consequences would be for humans and for the world if viruses just disappeared. Ultimately, as much havoc as they have wreaked throughout history, scientists are starting to understand that viruses are a part of life on Earth as we know it. To understand what would happen if viruses vanished, first we need to understand what a virus is. But that is actually not a straightforward question. A lot of it has to do with how their reproductive life cycles typically happen in two stages. The first is when a virus infects a host and reprograms its cells. It uses the cell's machinery to churn out copies of itself, often damaging or destroying that cell in the process. Some viruses, like the one that causes COVID-19, stick to the machinery outside of the nucleus to create copies. Other viruses enter the cell's nucleus and incorporate their genetic material directly into the cell's genome and direct the creation of copies from there. The second is the stage outside of host cells, where virions escape the infected cells and hang out in the external environment, in the air, on surfaces, and more. These are virus particles, with molecules of either DNA or RNA, encased in a protein shell, sometimes with a fatty envelope. That virus particle can't do much of anything when it's just out in the world. In fact, the idea of what a virus is up for debate in the scientific community. Until recently, the idea has been that a virion in its non-living stage, just out there in the environment, is synonymous with the virus. But some researchers think it's time to abandon this view, which they say is reductive because it overlooks the way viruses transform infected cells. This is why you hear people in the news talking about virus particles in addition to the virus. Those virus particles are the virions. Instead, that virus-making factory within a living cell would be a more comprehensive version of what a virus is, because it's basically taking that living cell and totally repurposing what it does. The emphasis would be on that process. Some researchers argue that shifting the view of the virus itself could open up new avenues of scientific investigation. For example, it might help us understand where they came from. And there are three leading hypotheses as to how viruses arose. The first, sometimes known as the progressive hypothesis, is that they arose from pieces of DNA or RNA that gained the ability to jump between cells. The second, sometimes called the reductive or regression hypothesis, is that viruses are remnants of cells that eventually lost their ability to exist independently, forcing them to parasitize other cells to reproduce. In the third scenario, viruses evolved on multiple independent occasions. In this view, they may have first arisen before cells did, and evolved in tandem with all life on Earth. This could have happened in different cellular organisms from genes that acquired the ability to infect cells and use them to replicate. Some scientists think that any of these different scenarios could be true for different viruses that infect different kinds of hosts. So, for example, viruses that infect bacteria would have come from genes that escaped from bacteria. And viruses that infect eukaryotes, organisms whose cells have nuclei, would have come from totally different genes that jumped from there. In the view of viruses as virus factories within cells, there just couldn't be a virus before there was a cell. So no matter what you call these pre-cellular genetic bits and bobs, scientists are starting to think that viruses have been around as long as life on Earth. And so there would be a lot of hypothetical potential consequences to poofing them away, especially if you poofed them from history. First, viruses aren't all bad. The virus that causes COVID-19 is plenty bad, and so it's easy to overlook that fact. When we think of viruses, we often tend to think about pathogenic or disease-causing viruses. Those are the viruses that cause harm to the host when they hijack its cells to reproduce, like SARS-CoV-2, and the virus that causes smallpox and measles. Non-pathogenic viruses, on the other hand, don't harm hosts like pathogenic ones do, which is where we come to the idea of the human virome. That is, viruses that live alongside or inside you without ever really bugging you. It's thought to be an integral part of the microbiome, or the collection of trillions of microbial cells in your body. Bacteria get a lot of the attention when it comes to the microbiome and its effect on our health, but we have plenty of viruses doing their things too. In humans, scientists surmise that viromes stabilize by around age 2, and that each individual's virome has a slightly different makeup of different types of viruses. Studies of metagenomic data, or the DNA sequences found in environmental samples, both within and outside organisms' bodies, have helped researchers shed light on the makeup of the virome. It consists of viruses that infect bacteria, viruses that infect other microscopic organisms, and viruses that infect human cells. As part of the microbiome, evidence suggests that the virome plays a major role in our health. Like, recent studies of the human virome have shown that different viruses live in different parts of the body, like the urinary tract, gastrointestinal tract, oral cavity, blood, and lungs. And while we don't fully know yet what they're doing there, we do have some clues. For example, a healthy mouth has plenty of viruses helping keep the oral microbes in check. Increased presence of some viruses that naturally colonize the oral cavity and respiratory tract can throw that balance off and lead to various diseases, including periodontal disease. But even with interest in the virome on the rise and papers piling up, we don't really understand it yet. One thing seems to be clear: the virome and its makeup can definitely influence our health. So even if you could just poof away all viruses in your body right now, you might want to think twice. And humans aren't the only animals with viromes that vary in their different tissues. All kinds of animals, plants, and other organisms are known to have them. Not only do viruses play a role in the health of organisms, they're also thought to shape the biosphere. Viruses are everywhere in Earth's ecosystems in big numbers. And one of the major impacts of viruses in the environment is in how their presence affects communities of bacteria. Based on what researchers have learned so far, their significance is most obvious in the ecology of oceans. They constantly shape the diversity of natural bacterial populations under the sea in a very big way. They're present in our oceans in such astronomical numbers, it's estimated that they would stretch from here past the next 60 galaxies if laid end to end. Every second, hundreds of trillions of viral infections occur in the ocean. Every day, they're thought to kill around 20% of all marine bacteria, which, just saying, is a lot. And that turns out to be a huge part of how nutrients and energy cycle in the ocean. For instance, all those dead bacteria are thought to release enough iron to support the needs of phytoplankton. The composition of Earth's atmosphere also hinges on the shuffling of all that organic material from viral killing activity in the ocean, to the tune of 3 gigatons of carbon sequestered every year. And this is a very abridged list of viruses' oceanic activity. Viruses' role in soil isn't as well studied as in the ocean, solution, but the importance is clear. 1 gram of soil can house up to 10 billion viruses, and they can be present in bigger numbers than bacteria. Studies suggest that viruses may have a major impact on carbon and nutrient cycles on land, just as they do in the ocean. They're also a fount of genetic diversity in both the soil and the ocean. A lot of what we've talked about gets to the importance of viruses for organisms and ecosystems right now. But here's where we need to remember what every time travel show and movie says about changing things in the past. Don't do it, even if it seems like a great idea in your head. Basically, if viruses did co-evolve with life forms, then they're sort of part of life on Earth. Since viruses need cells, researchers think the ancestry of both viruses and cellular organisms were intertwined. One part of that is that the trajectory of life on Earth could have been drastically different without viruses to infect organisms. But life on Earth is also what it is because large parts of so many organisms' genomes are made up of viral DNA, including humans and other mammals. The viruses that incorporate their DNA into host cells' genomes don't just reproduce themselves during an infection. When they infect tissues involved in reproduction, like the ones that make sperm and egg cells, their DNA can also be passed to future generations when the host reproduces. Scientists think that this has provided lots of raw material for evolution to act on. In humans, for instance, around 8% of our genomes are made up of viral sequences, which is probably more than you would have guessed. Throughout history, scientists think viruses have infected the cells that make human eggs and sperm, incorporating their genetic material, which gets passed on in the genes. Over time, those sequences can change and even acquire beneficial functions. So as benevolent as it might seem to wish for viruses to cease to exist in the past, present, and future, definitely leave out the past. Because if you do that, and I'm just advising you as a person who may get a wish, if you leave it out of the past, that would be great, because if you include it, we probably won't exist anymore. Also, you might want to specify in your wish to only eliminate the human pathogens, the ones that actually do us harm, because most viruses don't mess with us at all. And vanishing all viruses might turn out to be a pretty short-sighted move. And there's still so much more to investigate about viruses, so much that we don't know, especially now that the thinking is shifting to viewing them not as just virions, but as everything they do inside hosts. We've even found giant viruses that are bigger not only in physical dimensions, but the size of their genomes, and they're a lot closer to cellular forms of life than their smaller cousins. Their existence has led to several hypotheses arguing that viruses aren't non-living, an argument that's often been made. Instead, they suggest that viruses are another domain of life, along with eukaryotes, bacteria, and archaea. Some scientists are even hypothesizing that they were integral to the origin of eukaryotes, including the source of important genes or even cellular structures. So there you have it, folks. It might be tempting to fantasize about a virus-free world with all of the bad that viruses have done, killing swaths of humans throughout history and putting a big old damper on everything now. But the more that we learn about viruses, the more they show themselves to be an example of how the good, the bad, and the ugly of nature are often inextricable.
Okay, so for all the gnarly flus and cancers and deadly infections that viruses bring us, I guess we shouldn't wish for an end to all of them. Maybe, like those experts suggested in the bird flu video, a better solution is to learn more about them and prepare vaccines for times when we need them. Just educating ourselves about viruses is the first step in preventing the next pandemic. And for that reason alone, let's hope that this video goes viral.